This is The New Criterion. I'm James Pinero, Executive Editor. February 29th only comes around every 4 years, but it has an interesting history. Byron was born on this day in 1692. Rossini was born on this day in 1792. And Jimmy Dorsey in 1904. In 1504, aware of a lunar eclipse to take place that evening, Christopher Columbus convinced Jamaican natives to provide him with supplies. Perhaps this is where Mark Twain got his idea for a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's court. What's more, in 1704, an Indian raid on Deerfield, Massachusetts, killed 56 villagers and took 100 captives. A gruesome event, now certainly praised by anti-colonialists and intifadists everywhere. Moving on to February 29, 2020, the United States and the Taliban signed the Doha Agreement, an event ushering in the lasting peace and prosperity that country now enjoys. But most importantly, on Leap Day 2024, the New Criterion welcomed the writer and historian Dominic Green to speak to assembled guests at the Players Club on the pressing question, is there life after woke? We now join our friends, young friends, and Galliard Society members for this evening talk with Dom Green, beginning with my introductory remarks. Dominic Green has been writing for the New Criterion since 2015. Only 2015.
I deserve time off for good behavior.
You came in hot. It wasn't long before Dom was writing for nearly every issue, covering such topics as Elena Ferrante, Hilary Mantel, the Venice Biennale, nature writing in Britain, Islamism and the decline of the French identity, the disparagement of Israel at American universities, which appeared in January 2017 and was a forewarning of what's to come. Dom has also written for us on Joyce's Ulysses, Israel's national literatures, English style, WAS, military service, Saul Bellow, and Israel and the intellectual left, and much more. You can now find Dom writing regularly for several publications and three or more times a month as a contributor to the Wall Street Journal. On Twitter, one writer recently made this observation of Dom's work. If you're interested in the art and craft of reviewing, study this. In his writing, Dom has a particular knack for extracting just that right aperçu, the kind of detail we like to share around the water cooler, those of us who still go to an office. For example, that Gregory Bateson, Margaret Mead's third husband and a guru of psychedelic drugs, injected dolphins on the set of the television series Flipper with LSD, because he wanted them to learn English. Unfortunately, those dolphins still cannot read Dominic Green. Dom is the author of several books, starting with a biography of his father, the saxophonist Benny Green. His most recent book is The Religious Revolution, The Birth of Modern Spirituality, 1848 to 1898, published by FSG in 2022. Now, before I hand things over to Dom, I wanted to make sure you knew about the New Criterion's upcoming events. We have several. On March 14th, we will host a book party with Alexander Chula, a classicist turned doctor, with a story about his time in the small African country of Malawi. On April 4th, we will have a celebration with Peter Vertachnik, the winner of the 23rd New Criterion Poetry Prize. On April 18th, we will offer an event on classical painting with Judy Kudlow at the Salmagundi Club. And on March 2nd, at our annual gala, we will honor Ronald S. Lauder with our Edmund Burke Award for Service to Culture and Society. Tickets are going fast for this event. And on June 6th, we hope to see you at our season closer office party. If you're not already, consider becoming a friend of the New Criterion and join us for these events. Isaac Slaw and Lee Harrington. Isaac, Lee, are here with more details, and they also want me to suggest that if you are not a subscriber to the New Criterion, which I find hard to believe, but if you're not a subscriber,
We have the means to remedy that affliction with tact and delicacy. And see them. Finally, I note that this is the inaugural meeting of our Galliard Society, our planned giving program. I send a special greeting to our charter members here tonight. This is the program. Roger Kimball, who unfortunately is not able to join us, has asked me to say the following words on his behalf. I very much regret that duty has taken me away when I could be here with you celebrating the Friends of the New Criterion, first official meeting of the Galliard Society, and profiting from the wit and wisdom of our friend, Dominic Green. Alas, despite my best efforts, I've yet to master the art of being in two places at once. I am pleased that our Legatus Legionis, James Pinero, that would be me, can stand in as the New Criterion's impresario for the evening. I will leave you in his capable hands, pausing only to note that Galliard, besides describing what the dictionary tells us is a sprightly dance with complicated steps, hails from an adjective that means valiant, sturdy, lively, brisk, qualities that we seek to embody with our monthly forays into the public arena, and with you, old Galliard members, surely embodying your thoughtful and far-seeing commitment to the perpetuation of our efforts. I will end by mentioning that Galliard is also the name of the elegant type font in which the New Criterion and his website are printed. Perhaps James will tell you a bit about his much history, which I'm happy to do. He will certainly, I know, echo my thanks to all of you who have congregated here at the Players Club to celebrate the New Criterion, and the most recipient of praise, Dominic Green. I look forward to seeing you at our next event. Well, I certainly do echo Roger's gratitude to our gallery members, and invite others here tonight to consider joining their ranks. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dominic Green.
Thank you very much. Thank you, James. Thank you all for being here. I'm delighted to see so many of these people here. I'm amazed you haven't gotten better to do. Can you hear me at the back?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. So the subject of my talk this evening is there life after woke? And without spoiling the end, the answer is yes. And I'm here to tell you why. But before we begin, a quiz. What do T.S. Eliot and Joseph Stalin have in common? There's two things. Yes, you to the back, sir.
They were both seminarians.
Oh, that's three things. Thank you. I knew this was going to be a tough crowd. Okay. And any other things? Seminarians? What else? Well, they were both poets, and they both had an interest in banks. You will remember T.S. Eliot, his day job, for 8 years, he worked at Lloyds Bank in London, and in the evenings he wrote The Wasteland and edited The Criterion. And Stalin robbed banks, which tells us quite a lot about his understanding of economics. And then he gave up the poetry and the bank robbery and got on with his main ambition, destroying Russia. Now, the reason I mention this is because there is an adage in show business called no business, no show. In other words, you have to have an economy, you have to have a business model before you can produce poetry, art, or anything else. All of it really requires that kind of foundation. And of course, in the Renaissance, the foundation was one of patronage. And then in the 19th century, it was mass market fiction and so on. And in our time, we have seen all of this changed completely by the internet. And the internet, of course, has also changed politics, as we know it, as well. And one of the interesting things that has happened is, in the 18th century, people didn't talk about the democratic people, so they talked about the mob. And the mob became, in time, the people. And now the people are being turned into the flash mob, again, by the internet. That's an example of how we've reordered all our lives. And this brings me, I suppose, to some reflections on the revolution which has recently taken place in the United States, in which we've all had the pleasure of watching. Now, every 80 years or so, American society reformulates itself. And unlike France, but quite like Britain, It happens under the same constitution. You know, the French keep declaring a new republic, a new constitution, every time a new deferment. While in Britain or America, we say nothing has changed, but of course things drastically do change. And American society has also renewed itself through religious upheavals, which of course often we call Great Awakenings. And the most recent one, of course, is the Great Awakening. And it's only striking, really, because it's all of the form of an awakening without the content. In other words, it's not particularly Christian. It's purely political, purely about power. And like all revolutions, it reaches a certain point and then it boils over and then there's all the great detumescence and sadness. And I'm sorry about that. Is that just me? Now, this one, of course, began around in 2008 and peaked in 2020. This is the year of George Floyd and the Wu flu. And as Wordsworth would have said, had he attended, bliss it was in that dorm to be alive, especially if you were a trans college student with a big bag of weed. But for the rest of us, it was like watching a parody of 1968. And parody is where art goes to die. Not with a bang, but with a chuckle. And the Great Awakening was probably the death rattle of the Western revolutionary tradition. So I told you I was bringing good news, and that is in fact part of it. So recall, if you will, the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone. Does anyone remember this? Chaz. It was set up as a police-free district in Seattle in the heady summer of 2020. And its hard drug market fell under the command of Raz Simone. Because we love the arts, and Raz Simone was privately educated and a rapper. And before becoming the dictator of Chaz, had put out an album called, I kid you not, Cognitive Dissonance. And he and his friends gave salutary beatings to anyone who crossed him, and he controlled Chaz with an iron hand, and then sort of was dropped from view. Two people were accidentally murdered at the Chaz checkpoint, and Mr. Simone is currently facing allegations of rape, assault, and sex trafficking. And no one knows where he is. Perhaps, like T.S. Eliot and Stalin before him, he is working on a slim volume of poetry. And where are we now? Well, we have seen terrible destruction, pointless vandalism, witch hunts, riots. Statues of good people have been overthrown. Decent people have been hounded out of public life for the lowest of reasons. And monuments to crooks, junkies, and gender cases have been erected in their stead. And if the kids didn't read everything on their phones, they probably would have burned the books as well. But we are now at that moment, as I said, in the revolutionary excitement when everything cools off. Chaz is no more. We've missed our chance to take part in an ideal society, and Raz may be no more for all we know. And the technical term for this is a thermidor moment. Now, this is not an option in a seafood restaurant. The historians among you will know that it is named in the moment in 1793 when the French Revolution cooled off. The public, then as now, were never big on the terror when they realised that anyone could be cancelled by the guillotine, you know, if you ran your neighbours in. And so the revolution cooled, and the worst of its leaders were executed by the machines they'd created. Not unlike Claudine Gay, the sadly misunderstood ex-president of the ex-university called Harvard. And the crimes of the revolution were suddenly acknowledged by the very people who had looked the other way for years. Which is not unlike the Atlantic magazine, which was all in 2020 and is now running articles exposing the collective madness of editorial meetings at the New York Times. And then everyone looked around for a strong leader, or at least normalcy, and they had, of course, Napoleon, so be careful what you wish for. And again, here is the good news. The enemy have left the battlefield. Now, they may still be barricaded in their ivory towers and pouring chamber pots of political correctness on us if we go too close, but they are no longer in the arena or in the trenches or in the mud or in the field because they don't really care about art or books or music or all the other things that we call culture. They care only about power, political power. And of course, only very recent art of any kind can be converted into the currency of power, which is politics. And so most of our big institutions are only really interested in recent things, because they do politics. Because politics means power, they seek power. And as I say, this is the good news, because it means that the field is open. All the monuments of human intelligence and aspiration from before about 1980 are ours for the taking. And we, too, are in this thermidor moment. And if you're sending your children or your grandchildren to college, you're thinking, which institutions can be saved from themselves? Which are going to have to be completely rebuilt? And which are lost causes? And to return to the internet, now the internet did a great deal to destroy the old way of doing things, including the old business models for books or arts or newspapers even, and also the old way of politics. But the internet also connects people across great distances, which means that a young person in a small town anywhere in the world can find their way to the new criteria. And now and begin to understand that even though they are up to their armpits in nihilism and stupidity, there are people who really do care. And you are not alone. And the age of T.S. Eliot and Joseph Stalin was also the age of the little magazines, like the first criterion. And they changed the way we understand literature and the world around us, even though T.S. Eliot's criterion, which he basically made on his kitchen table in the evenings, the most important magazine, really, of all time in some ways, had less than 1,000 subscribers at its peak. In other words, the little magazines were what Stalin and Lenin would have called the vanguard. And that's what the New Criterion is as well, and it has thousands more readers. Now, there is no better magazine in the world. When I was living in a small town in England and trying to understand the world around me, I found my way to the New Criterion. In those days, it wasn't online. And it took me many, many years to work towards actually meeting these people who, to me, I couldn't believe that it existed. And here I would ask you this, here's another question for you. What connects the English philosopher and Wagner fan Roger Scruton to the Australian goth rocker Nick Cave? Now, one answer, actually, I thought there was a single thing, but a member of the staff, Isaac Sly, sent me a photo earlier of Nick Cave reading the New Criterion. So, apart from that. Well, the answer is that they both came to the conclusion that Roger Scruton came to after witnessing the revolution of 1968 in Paris, which is that it was ludicrous Marxist gobbledygook, unquote, and that it is better to conserve things than to pull them down. And I quote Scruton. He said, the real reason people are conservatives is that they're attached to the things that they love. They are attached to their family, their friends, their religion, and their immediate environment. And earlier this month, Nick Cave, the Australian goth rocker, has anyone here ever listened to Nick Cave's music? I mean, you have my deepest sympathy. it's hard going, isn't it? It's very... Well,
life's a wasteland.
Yes, it is a way. It is a bit of a wasteland, you're right. Well, you may be surprised. I was astounded to hear this. Oh, Nick Cave said he has a conservative temperament. He said it has something to do with a deep understanding of the inherent value of the world and its vulnerable and precarious nature. This temperament, he said, is suspicious of the impulse to tear things down, dismantle things, cancel things, burn things to the ground. We need to be careful with the world. A conservative has a melancholy understanding that it's a lot easier to tear things down than to build them back up. So Nick Cave, by experience, is sounding much like Roger Scruton. And as that other Roger Kimball tells us very often, the real counterculture these days is conservative. In other words, and this too is a moment of great opportunity, because the woke revolution has peaked, And the internet broke the old model for communications and doing business, but it has created a new one that works for small outfits like this. And everybody, quietly, is now admitting that actually the Conservatives were right all along. It is better to preserve than destroy. It's better to build than to pull things down. And this is still T.S. Eliot's world, not Stalin's world, after all. And it's Nick Cave's world and Roger Scruton's, and it's the New Criterion's world. And those of you who support it are preserving and building that world for everyone today, whether they know it or not, and for their children and grandchildren. And in time, you will all be thanked for doing this. So I say to the New Criterion, and all Miss Elliot.
But I do want to ask you, 68, you bring up the French Revolution. You know, you have those revolutionaries, they were digging up the corpses of the French kings and making bonfires and so on. Did they come to regret, we shouldn't have dug up all those guys, and I thought that was kind of gross that we did that, and you know, after 68, did they regret it? What happens to these revolutionaries?
A lot of it, I think people become embarrassed by their behaviour, and I think they realise that it's not deeply rooted in conviction, that it was following the crowd, literally, or trying to get on professionally, which you can't separate these things. And so there's a quiet agreement to... to pretend it never happened, as it were. And everyone agrees not to talk about how they behaved, or the silly slogans they put in their windows, or digging up, you know, the dead and throwing their bones around. For some reason, they prefer not to talk about it.
Okay. Questions?
Yeah, please.
Be honest, please.
I have a question. Thank you so much for your exposé. It's very interesting. I have one observation and one question. Observation is that in the era of the internet, it's amazing how information travels. Like the interview with Tina Robinson was watched by my friend in Spain, and we're able to talk about it, which is quite remarkable. However, when you say that you're hopeful for the future, I do share your hope. But at the same time, I think embarrassment for me is not a consequence, that's enough. Because what about accountability?
Yes.
I mean, there are people who, you know, display criminal behavior.
Yes.
You know, like during the election of 2020, by saying that, you know, the country or laptop was a Russian disinformation campaign.
Yes, yes.
What about accountability?
Right. For those of you who are in the cheap seats, I'm going to summarize this. It's a very good question. The gains and losses of the internet, the fact that communication allows liars and frauds and people asking for your credit card number just as much weight as people trying to tell you what actually is going on. And that absolutely is, I think, a real problem. And Tucker Carlson is a very interesting case because sometimes he interviews people at length with a seriousness that you won't get on a regular television channel. And then sometimes he has someone in a tin hat talking about aliens or something, and you're thinking, why are these two kinds of information, one which is valuable and one which is actually an attack on reality itself, why are they going on in the same space? And that is the nature of the internet. And in some ways it is the ultimate democratic small d, that is, medium, in that you get all the good and the bad. The question of accountability, which you mentioned, is a crucial one. Because to have accountability, you have to have history, and you have to have a record. You know, we used to talk of the paper of record, for instance. And I won't even name it.
Because the New York Post.
The New York Post. That's the paper of record. Yeah. It's very, very important that we retain a sense of history, and write down what happens for good and bad. Because I do think it corrects people over time to know, actually, that it will be written down. And therefore, the attack on public monuments, on the very idea of what American history is, on literally on the foundations and values of American society, is in some ways, a deliberate attempt to create a situation when we all live in a permanent present, which was also, of course, the situation that the totalitarian regimes of the 20th century did create, where there was no past, and therefore you couldn't form a relative judgment, which is what historical judgments are. Is it better to be under the terror than Napoleon? I mean, you know, we could go on and on and on. Without that information, you can't make those judgments. You're stuck in a permanent present. In liberal Western societies, we didn't have totalitarianism like that. Instead, we have John Lennon saying, imagine there's no up, down, heaven, earth, past, tomorrow. Everything is in a permanent present, which is basically a kind of consumerism. I mean, the guy was living in a mansion with a white piano. He was not like, you know, an early Christian, you know, monk out in the desert. Well, let's face it, you know. That is the danger of the affluence and freedom that we have. It's the one that Aldous Huxley describes in Brave New World, where, you know, if everyone is sufficiently entertained, maybe they, you know, won't care about politics. And all of these things became very clear to us, I think, in the last 3-4 years. People compared COVID, which happens almost simultaneously, you know, with the 2020 elections, to before a tidal wave, when the tide goes out, and you see a whole seabed that has been hidden from view. And this suspension of normal service allowed us to see how things have been run and have worked. And you can't go back after that, for good or bad. And it's very important, I think, therefore, that we take the opportunity now to start setting up institutions, accountability, ways of doing things for the next phase of history. And it is a generational thing. It's our children, our grandchildren. Holding universities to account, for instance, from being a bunch of communists and anti-Semites, and charging $70,000 a year for it, which is, you know, one of the greatest scams anybody has ever thought up. Imagine talking of, you know, I mean, Stalin and the seminary. Imagine saying, we're going to set up a seminary for communism, and we're going to loot people's savings for it. I mean, that's, you know, only in America. You know, so all, and we now see all of this in a way that we didn't see, it couldn't be seen before. Or rather, if you said it, you were viewed as a crank. But actually, no, there's been a huge, huge shift, for good and bad. And you know, it's up to us now to make the best of it. It's a very good and complicated question.
Yeah. Another question. Tell me what. Is the law of history that all civilizations and hegemons eventually decline? Mm-hmm. It started with the Sumerians. It has never been, and it's invalid ever since. In fact, it's probably more valid than most of the laws of physics, which are only approximations. Is there any reason to believe that the United States won't decline also? Is it possible that we are now in a state of decline?
Right.
Do you think it can be reversed? Perhaps we are now in the inevitable state of decline of the United States. Would you please answer that?
That's biggie as well. Is the United States in a permanent decline in the way of all great powers and civilizations? Well, it's not going very well at the moment. I'll say that. But I can also refer you to a previous hegemonic power. If you were in Britain in 1783, 1784, and they just signed the Treaty of Paris, and you just lost America, you would think it was all over, but in fact, the British had another 100 years or more in the tank, and in fact, pivoted eastwards and built a completely new kind of empire. So, my conclusion from this is this. The United States has unparalleled resources, natural resources, human resources, because anybody with any ambition wants to come here, right? The world may detest the United States, but it will gladly sell its passport tomorrow to have the kind of opportunity and the kind of freedom that comes with it. So again, the question comes back to what to do. And coming from a country which has had its day, it's very concerning to see people allowing the resources to run down, you know, everything to go into the red. It's a self-inflicted and a largely unnecessary injury. In some ways, it's the collateral damage of success, which is you build bigger and bigger bureaucracies and they soak up more and more money. And in other ways, it's from perhaps too much comfort. But no other society has these resources. China does not have the demography. India does not have the political tradition. The Western Europeans don't seem to have either. There is no major contender in that way. So it is absolutely in the hands of Americans. And what I see at the moment is something really that you can trace all the way through American history. It's not like the only Americans in 1680 were Puritans. There was also Catholic aristocrats down in the Carolinas, for instance. There have always been very different groups contending for power in the US. And what we have now is a very sharp contention, I believe, between the people. I think Edward Lookback, the writer, said about half the people, he didn't say it with an accent like mine, obviously, about half the people in America believe in the constitutional system. They like constitutional government, the republic, accountability, laws, limits, all these things. And about half the other people are prepared to go with a completely different kind of system, which, if it's fully implemented, will attempt to turn the United States into a vast Scandinavia. And if you've been to Scandinavia lately, I can tell you, it's really not worth the effort. So you have this big, big struggle, and it's more than the struggle of the coast versus the interior. It's the struggle of two completely different conceptions of where political power lies. And again, this is at the heart of what makes America, because there are people who say we are choosing to form a society and these are its rules, versus the people who frankly would rather have a king or an emperor and the kind of system that drives power downwards, which is what empires and kings do, they issue orders. And again, I don't believe, it's not looking particularly good as of now, but I do believe, as I said, that all the advantages are still with the United States. And half the country badly wants to stay American in that way. So
I hope you're right, at least for the immediate future.
Oh, I hope I'm right. For purely selfish reasons, because it's not just America that would go down with America. It's all of Western Europe and the very conception of freedom and limited government depend on this country and no other.
Here, here.
One more question I see over here.
You're going to ask about Nick Cave, aren't you?
I've got Nick Cave stories. What I want to ask is, what makes you think that the woke revolution is in retreat and not reconstituted? Because it's my impression that the only thing that has changed is that most of America has now become aware of what any reasonable person, let's leave aside conservative with a small c person on any campus in the United States, has known for decades.
Yeah, this is very true. The revolution has happened, but the idea is now in every single major institution of American life. Much the same has happened in Europe as well, right? This is what happens to revolutions. It's like a virus. When people talk about the woke mind virus, that's exactly how it does. It chews up the idea. Institutions are meant to serve people, and then they come to serve the people who work in institutions. The enthusiasm of the Russian Revolution lasted maybe a decade, and they had no way of voting the buns out. In the United States, you have a huge amount of accountability and control at every level of government, and therefore it's possible to clean the stables quite quickly. And as you say, the general public has now become aware of this. The moment I think when I realized things were tipping was when the madness in the schools sort of fanned out from the expensive private schools in Washington, D.C., into Northern Virginia. And the parents of Northern Virginia simply went berserk, as they say in Scandinavia. And that was the end of that. That was the end of the silliness. And I do believe in that most people are actually quite sensible and will not be told that up is down and will not sell their children out and all the rest of it. But this is going to take a long time. Yeah.
It's like they have to be deprogrammed, actually. The people who run our institutions say things, and you see it in their eyes. They don't believe this. They're saying it because they need to make the mortgage and keep their health insurance. They know they are lying. And actually, that's not a conviction that they have. That's just kind of like words they don't even understand, because they know these words aren't even logical half the time. So actually, they may have institutional power, but their hands are weak. You know, they have the levers, but no real will to do it. And the funny thing is, a completely different orthodoxy could be established, and they would be just as zealous in pushing that. So that's why I'm saying, let's make them actually say something sensible. Because you can't have a complex society without institutions. We need them. So we have, therefore, as I said, to clean the stables, force these people to actually be accountable and do their jobs properly and serve the public they're meant to serve. Yes?
I have another question, which is important, and that I see as a blocker for this whole area of boldness, is the weaponization of the justice system.
Yes.
And when I see a political system in place, which tries everything it can, is it bound or not?
Yes.
I mean, have you watched the trial in New York? The trial
yes.
is actually forbidding the lawyer
yes.
of President Trump to speak. Threatening her Jetta if she opened her mouth to defend
yes.
it. And
it's
to
nuts.
Me, I don't see how do we fix that? Because
right. The question, the weaponization of the justice system. Yeah, the weaponization of the justice system. Well, this is a very, very bad thing, and this is a symptom of the ideological madness and overreach of our time. The good news is that everyone is seeing it for what it is. And my understanding is that when people ask the public, most of them are kind of shrugging it off. It's not news to them that Donald Trump might not be a man of impeccable character. They know this already. And
that's what bogus charges.
Yes, of course, most of what he's accused of is silly, and I do think they understand that these are largely politically motivated, certainly in terms of timing. And I think they also understand that the president has done much the same when it comes to storing documents and so on. I think most people actually tune this stuff out until they are forced to vote. So it is a very bad symptom. But whether it will have the same impact that we worry now in England's time, I don't know. I suspect most people think that politics is a very, very dirty game, and they really don't like the politicisation of the courts in particular. So that could easily rebound on the people doing this, not just if they fail to get convictions, but also simply by being seen to put their thumb on the scale. I think most people think that's a very, very bad thing to do.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dominic Green.